that's the fun part, isn't it?
What's that? The R&D?
It's sort of like conjuring up the idea.
Yeah.
And ending up where we don't know where you're going to end up.
Yeah, and I think at the cutting edge of science, there aren't any experts, right?
Yeah.
And peer-reviewed papers are often just bullshit, right?
And we are back, episode 30 of Not an Audiophile, the podcast, season 2. And today we meld together the last three interviews that we did at Sydney 2025. And although the show aspect is kind of irrelevant, it just happens to be where we met up. Three very interesting people, great interviews. Steve from Secret Chord regarding his rather interesting and highly optimized record cleaning system. Mark from Avation, who happens to be the Vivid importer, and no, there isn't a theme, there is no payoffs. We seem to be a little bit stuck on Lawrence Dickey at the moment, although he is, of course, a very interesting guy to be stuck on. And then, of course, speaking of interesting guys, Steve from Spectra Flora. I had a very enjoyable chat with him. Admittedly, at the very end of the show, we were both probably a little tired, but the interview revitalised me. Let's have a listen. This episode of Not an Audiophile, the podcast, is sponsored by the subwoofer people, Harbottle Audio. If you're serious about subwoofers or just tired of muddy bass and bloated hype, check out Harbottle Audio. With over 800 subwoofer configurations, they solve problems from Trinov waveforming to vintage analog systems needing an actual musical subwoofer and not some hopeless air pump. No gimmicks, just pure, unadulterated bass engineered to a performance standard focused way beyond the mundane THD versus SPL. And yeah, the CEO wrote this ad. That's how inept they are at marketing and how much they care about sound. www.harbottleaudio.com.
Okay, on that note, we're here with Stephen Price from Secret Chord Analog. And, Steve, tell us what... You've got a lot of different interesting products in your room. You've got open baffle speakers. You've got valve amplifier kits. You've got record cleaning products. You've got the record cleaning product on the counter here. You're showing me the contents of the box. Tell me more about it.
Well, Andrew, you're looking at Record Restore box set.
Record Restore...
Yes.
...is a product that you developed yourself, I believe.
Yep.
Tell me, that's interesting. So Australian made.
Yes.
We like that.
Like Edison, I discovered 1,000 ways not to make it.
Okay.
And so I just kept talking to people and asking questions.
Right.
Essentially. What you see today is very fine product.
It's beautifully packaged. Of course, it cleans records beautifully, I guess.
It does.
Yes.
And in fact, as we've been discovering in recent times, it in fact cleans them more effectively than one might imagine. So there's the initial clean.
Yes.
Right. And so we might do that on a new record.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we'll make sure there's no production residues there.
Oh, okay.
For the all-important first play.
So you're saying that you buy a brand new record, you pay good money for it.
Mm.
And it's not necessarily even clean out of the slip. Oh,
and in fact, you can argue it's worse today than back in the day. But I mean, you read stories about Montan wax as the mold release.
Right.
You probably never get anyone to tell you that's true or not. But I mean, certainly the record manufacturing environments, if you ever go to them, they're always filthy looking warehouses.
Well, I guess they are. It's kind of a filthy job in a way.
It is in a way.
So it is manufacturing.
The manufacturer is in the job of making records and distributing them.
Mm-hmm.
They could, I've read, with a little bit of extra expenditure, make those discs anti-static, but they don't. I mean, why would they want to spend money on your sound experience? They don't.
Okay.
PVC, the record.
Yeah, so they'd put an additive in it or something.
They could,
stop.
But they don't.
But they don't. Okay.
Yeah. So PVC... Static electricity is generated by what's called the triboelectric effect.
Okay.
Right? And there's a scale, as you'd imagine.
Yes.
And the further apart two substances are on that scale, when you rip them apart,
yeah,
the greater the charge.
Okay.
So interestingly, at the one end, you've got PVC,
mm-hmm,
and at the very other end of that scale is human skin. Dry human skin.
Yeah, okay.
So
you
that's why you know, dry fingers on a record, you can put a static charge on it. Simple as that. You know, people talk about the old covers, you know, they can impart a static charge.
Indeed, they did from memory, yes.
And in fact, now, as I've discovered, you can buy brand new records and they'll arrive without any extra charge. A static charge.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, I've got...
So extra charge, free of charge.
That's it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So in fact, I've got a video up on my YouTube channel, Secret Chord Analog, where you can see me unboxing my brand new Joni Mitchell LP.
Yeah.
And you can see that the anti-static sleeve is in fact glued almost to the record. So what I did was shredded newspaper, put it on a tray, and filmed what happened when I held the record over and all the paper jumped onto it.
Okay.
And my point in doing that is as soon as you take that record out of its sleeve, every microparticle in the air, is glued to the record.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Static electricity being a binder substance in that respect. So then I showed what happened when you treat the record with Record Restore.
Yeah.
Static charge gone.
Is that right? Okay, yep. So I could have saved my trouble of doing this interview and just watched your video.
Yeah, you
keep
could.
Going. So that's actually interesting. So it doesn't just clean the crud that's in the air at the record pressing plant, but it gets whatever oils or mold release material is employed. But perhaps you're saying more importantly, it gets rid of static.
And as in subsequent video, I got hold of an electrostatic meter to demonstrate this.
Yeah.
Again, new record, went through the process. Look, there's a charge, Record Restore, no charge.
Yeah.
Piece of silk. Rub the record. Remember what we used to do at school with the ebony rods, right?
Yeah.
Meter, no charge. So once you've used Record Restore on a record, you can't put
it
a charge.
It doesn't even... Okay. All right. So that would imply it leaves some kind of film, but you're...
Positive ions.
Crikey, this sounds technological.
Hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, we won't go into the science too much, but that's an interesting thing. So Not only does it get rid of whatever static charge may or may not have been,
and that's important
factory,
because that then releases microparticles.
Yeah,
you can't get microparticles off a record
until
you've neutralised the charge.
Yeah, okay, that's a super decent.
The trucking
industry
discovered this. They have special detergents to clean their trucks because otherwise they can't get the dirt off because it's electrostatically charged.
Okay, so this makes a huge amount of sense. So. Whatever you do with your carbon fibre brush, whether they work or not, the point is there's no way it can work if the thing is charged and attracting crud to it. The crud will just stay
stuck
to the surface.
Yeah, that's just a deductive path. In fact, we offer a little record cleaning brush, which we think is far more effective, that you use on restored records because you can't put a charge back on. And this is a brush that... We say you hold it against the spin of the record, and any surface fluff, because you're not, I mean, it's already been restored, so there's nothing in the groove. Just for that surface stuff, because if the pandemic taught us anything, it's you don't blow, because when you blow, you spit. So if you blow dust off your record, you're spitting on it.
Well, you are, absolutely, yeah.
So our brush points in the direction of what's coming in, gets jammed in the bristles, and just dust it off on you.
Okay, well...
I'll show you one of those.
When we cease recording, I'll have a look. Mm. Now, so you... That sounds amazing. I mean, I don't want to sound too ignorant when I have... I guess because record cleaning is potentially a complex process, I have conveniently just ruled it out of my life.
Andrew, could I just suggest to you that we'll talk about a lot of things and it can sound technical and in fact, when you get right down to it, you're talking about particles and microns. So a lot of the so-called record cleaning is about the big bouldery stuff, if you like,
the stuff you can actually just see with the naked eye. Record looks dirty, I better clean it.
So what I'm talking about are binder substances, so fats, oils, grease, nicotine, that get into the grooves over time.
Yes.
Okay, so typically older records, and they will weld microparticles there. And some of those microparticles, for instance, are diamond dust.
Well, as in from the stylus.
That's
right.
I mean, it wears, it doesn't evaporate.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that stuff, and As I discovered from reading a paper written in 1954, okay. the very first and still the best review of record care and stylus care, this guy actually analysed what he found on discarded needles that used to be left at the record bar.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they were sapphire, yeah. so they wore out fairly quickly. People would take them in, oh, no, that's worn, drop in there.
Yeah.
He collected all of these things and analysed what was on the end of it. Very interesting.
Well, I kind of bet it was.
Anyway, so that stuff can get welded onto the groove walls.
Okay.
You've got to break the binder substance to get it off.
Yes.
And so here's the challenge.
Yes.
So what we're talking about doing is making a slurry in the groove.
Yeah.
Yep. Challenge is getting 100% that slurry out of the groove, having created it.
Yeah,
otherwise, what you've done at the bottom of the groove, which is V-shaped, end of the stylus, rounded, doesn't touch it.
No. Right?
You'll lift all that stuff into suspension, and if you don't get off 100% of it, you've left it on the groove walls.
Yes.
So that's where we are exemplary, because we remove 100% of what we've dissolved.
So this, the Record Restore, such a simple name, box set, which has all the bits in it you need. So that fluid that you spread about your record and let dry and then peel it off, which is, those things have been around for a while. Yours is a particular formula, though, that you feel gets as close as you're ever going to get to 100% of the gunk off.
Let me tell you a story. I've, of course, restored all of my collection.
Yep.
In preparing for this weekend, I thought, right, all the records I'm going to bring here, I'm not going to let any of them embarrass themselves in case they picked up something.
Yeah.
You know? So I've just given another restore.
Yep.
That included my Nilsson Schmilsson album from the 70s.
Okay. Nilsson Schmilsson.
Yeah. Yes, okay. So, and I'm speaking specifically about the track, the beginning of side two, Without You.
Okay.
Now, when I bought this, I had a little Phillips portable. You know, so little clip speakers on the top.
Yeah, and take it off 7-inch. This is what you owned when you bought that album.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
I'm interested in the fact that you bought it.
High speed.
Paid money for it.
Yeah,
okay, keep going.
He could sing, that boy. But this humble little arm couldn't track Without You. 2 points on it, it always skipped.
Yeah, okay, all right.
You do?
Yeah.
So we put up with that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, fast forward to now.
Yes.
And I'm playing at home on a Kuzma 4-point arm with a Power Mark II, moving coil cartridge. Same points. So at the same points, I thought it's been damaged by that first arm. Okay. This week, second record restore treatment, played it. No skip.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow. After 55 years.
First time I've heard it without it skipping.
It's funny you should say that, because this has now gone into trivia mode. But yeah, I had a record that, you know, back in the days when you used to buy a record and then you dub it off on a tape or a reel or whatever. And I was listening back years later to the open reel.
Mm-hmm.
I was fixing a machine or something and I was using that tape. And the muscle memory...
Yep. Okay.
I was because I'd always listened to that album with the skip, and it didn't really skip or get stuck. It just made a little and then it would go on, and I suppose it skipped forward. Or I don't know what it did, but the point is your formulation may well have fixed that problem. But the other weird thing is, which is just trivia, but I had listened to that. It was a great album. I can't remember what it was, but it was embedded in my brain that at this point on this track, it would do the little thing. But yeah, so I know what you're talking about as far as it, and it, you could, and I'd cleaned it a million times trying to get rid of it. What is it? You know, I didn't have a microscope to look at it to see what the hell it was. But if I'd had your magic ingredients and tried it twice, apparently, second time round it gets rid of it. Yeah, that's...
So
for people buying secondhand records...
Oh, absolute boom.
This stuff is just...
Absolute boom.
That's why you call it Record Restore, right?
Yeah, okay.
I'm super impressed. Of course, I'm also lazy, so I would do it. Yeah, but I don't have that many running up 20 or 30 records these days. But I'll do them for you.
I do have a cleaning service.
I didn't bring them with me.
Yeah, right.
Oh, so you can people send you their collection.
Yeah, yeah. I had a guy drive up from Sydney once because he wanted to check it out and wanted to see me do it. And I say, watch me do it. And he goes, will you do it for me? He said, I'm a lazy bastard.
Yeah, okay.
Sure. So anyway, he came back two or three times, did 100 records for him.
Wow.
He was so impressed with the results.
Well, that's super good. Secret Chord Analog, have a look at the website, etc., Google, what have you. But let's skip forward or sideways for a second because we are on a very limited time schedule.
Yep.
Tell me about these, I believe they're Japanese.
Yes.
Tube amplifier kits. The brand, I have no idea how to pronounce it correctly, but it does look like Elekit, yes. Yep. Or Elekit.
Yeah.
I have a sneaking suspicion they have been around since the dawning of time.
Oh, that they've been making kits for educational purposes for 30, 40 years. Yes, 30 years when they reached out to me.
Yeah.
And they reached out to me because they tripped over my Amp Camp concept.
Okay.
On the net.
Yeah.
So Amp Camp is where blokes come up to the mountain, spend a day building a tube amp and go home with a working product. Going, okay. You're beauty.
So you're based in Katoomba.
No, Wentworth Falls.
Wentworth Falls. Sorry for insulting you. but nonetheless, in the Blue Mountains or on the Blue Mountains. It's hard to be. You don't want to be in them.
No, you don't want to be in them.
No. So
amongst,
amongst, on,
except
around.
There aren't any mountains, but anyway.
Well, not real ones.
They're all plateaus.
Yes. It is still a beautiful part of the world. Mm. So you do that there, but people can buy an Elekit kit from you.
Correct. And people do. So the instructions that come with this, the last word was a customer in Alice Springs who bought one, and he wrote to me afterwards and he said, God, I enjoyed that. He said, I've got to tell you, I'm a technical writer and I haven't seen finer instructions than these.
Okay, well, that's an important thing when it comes to kits. Oh, I mean, clearly just, instructions.
You're trying seriously hard, in other words, not following the bouncing ball to stuff it up.
Now, I'm looking at this as an electronics technical person.
This is a little piece of cuteness that we added, the Perspex top, you can appreciate your handiwork.
And I'll take a picture of that.
Normally it's like this, so you get a...
Well, yes, yeah. And
people who come to Amp Camp will get one of those.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it right now. I'm not going to take photos while I'm talking on a podcast. It turns out I am. I've got a question. All looks beautiful.
Hmm.
It kind of looks like surface mount electrolytics.
That's my extremely fine soldering skill.
But what's happening there? They're actually a through hole.
Yeah, through hole printed circuit board. So.
But you've put surface mount caps. This is a technicality we shouldn't be talking about.
No, there's no surface mount technology there. That's,
no, but you've put leads on them and put them through the holes.
Solder on the other side.
Yeah, rightio. Yeah, no worries. No, it looks great. I'm not going to move across the room because we've got our recorder sitting in one position, but you have a range. I mean, annoyingly, people are not going to be listening to this podcast and coming to the show, because the podcast will come out about 2 days after the show finishes. But they can contact you and...
Sure. Or they can come up to Wentworth Falls and audition equipment.
Yes. Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you've got a little bit of a sort of a showroom thing happening.
Yeah, it's my lounge room.
Yeah, okay. That's very
I've got various production facilities on the property.
Yeah, okay.
As well as the homestead. But the main lounge room is a good size. And so, I've set up there. And,
okay.
People can come up and spin a few discs.
Yeah, all right. And if they're in Melbourne or, wherever, the Perth, Hobart, they can order. So these are Japanese kits, right?
Yep.
So they're...
Go together like Lego.
Transformer quality.
If you've got something wrong because something doesn't meet
physically.
Perfectly.
Yes. Transformers are made in Japan?
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, when we're talking transformers and tube amplifiers, you've got the main supply transformer, which is a C-core construction, really fine. But then you've got the output transformers. Yes. Now, this is where most of the magic is in a tube amp.
Indeed, it is.
And that's why, for instance, Prima Luna, Macintosh, etc., charge so much, because they design and wind their own transformers.
Yep.
It's a dark art.
Yes, it is.
If you get it wrong, your amp sounds like shit.
Yeah.
So what Elekit have started doing is they've reached out to Lundell of Sweden.
Okay.
Huge rep in terms of transformers, anything from moving coil step-ups to enormous numbers on long-distance voltage transfer, right across it. In fact, see that little red one on the top there? That's a phono stage. That's got two little Lundells in it. The power amps have Lundell-designed specialist units. Yeah. So you can buy the kit with a standard transformer, or you can upgrade it with Secret Chord Analog to a specifically designed Lundell unit.
Okay.
And it is audible.
Yeah, well, no doubt it is.
Yeah.
And the tubes are, I mean, I guess there are no tubes made in Japan anymore, but...
No, and in fact, a lot of, well, certainly Ellicott has, and I've seen this from other retailers, they've moved to a tubes not supplied with kit mode.
Okay, is that so, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, well, that maybe suits a lot of people.
Well, there's a specific reason, I think, for Ellicott too, because a lot of their amplifiers, apart from, and I've got the latest one that only came out January this year, the monoblocks the bottom there.
Yep.
So usually you're talking about an output from a tube amp about a dozen watts, somewhere between, you know, 9 and 12. 60 watts channel down there with the monoblocks because they're push-pull.
Yep.
And a more precise amp, if that's what you like. Some people prefer single-ended triode.
Yeah.
But certainly with the TU8400, which is top right there with the illuminated dial in the middle.
Yes.
And then what we're looking at here, the 8850, you can roll a whole range of tubes through this. It's called tube rolling. And I don't know if you can see down in the back there that sticker that I've put down underneath, and it talks about different kinds of tubes and what the setting would be for them.
I see that, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so high, low and mid plate currents.
So you've got a toggle, three-position toggle switch.
Yep.
And then
auto
you've got
bias,
a label that says
auto bias,
what position for which tubes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
And you
so,
can,
you, I mean, this is a tube roller's paradise.
It
right?
is.
Yeah.
And certainly what you can also do here in terms of the way you use the output transformers, you can use in triode mode or ultralinear, as they call it. And that's done at a flick of a switch.
Yep. No, real, yeah. And look, I suppose the one, absolutely, the one, I mean, these are a proper kit though. So you will be buying yourself a decent soldering iron and putting them together, is that right?
Yeah. If you're doing it yourself, then certainly you should have a heat-controlled iron. You don't want it to be too hot.
No.
You know, sort of 40 watts and temperature-controlled with a finish point, you know.
Bizarrely, you can buy a, you know, trade-quality soldering iron that, you know, for surprisingly, you know, $200 or $300. So you can buy an extremely good soldering iron to do, you know, but you can also, I guess, get a usable one for around 100 or so. Do you have a particular one
well,
that you recommend?
We offer, well, at Amp Camp, I've got, just trying to think of the name of them, temperature controlled amps where you can actually set the temperature of the tip.
Yes.
It's a soldering station.
Yeah, soldering station. Yeah,
so we use those, but you can get in a single unit similar temperature controlled, and we carry those as, I mean, we offer
and
a
you
basic
well.
Toolkit for
yeah, okay.
people who
oh,
don't
okay.
have
so
one.
You can, so, I mean, you've really got this worked out. All right, well, look, thank you, Steve. This has been very enlightening, and so just for clarity for listeners, you need to go to your website and you've got all of your products on there.
Yep.
I would guess. So and the website is secretcordanalog.au. Just.au. Okay, the new
very
the new top level domain. Yep.
Now I might just add that what we've done this year is we've formulated Secret Chord Analog system.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
So package deals. So I should have shown you that we've got a schedule for each day and in each hour we're going to team different loudspeakers with different amplifiers.
This is at the show.
Now, yeah, this coming show.
Yes.
But
except
for the
that unfortunately for the listeners,
I know,
the show
but I was about to say
for the next
week.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So tomorrow, the system choices will go up on the website.
Yeah, okay, all right.
And they'll be
and
there,
stay there
for a limited
by the time
and
this
until
episode
stocks
goes up. Yeah, okay.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. All right, well, there you go, folks. Go and
so
have
it,
now.
So it's a highly, I mean, for the quality of the sound produced, you won't buy better hi-fi.
No, okay. Hey, thanks again. Thanks for your time and have a great show.
Excellent. Thanks, Andrew.
No, it's a pleasure.
Looking for your tribe? Visit stereonet.com today. Join one of the world's largest online communities for hi-fi, home cinema, headphones and much more. Read the latest news and product reviews or check out the classifieds for the largest range of gear on sale. Membership is absolutely free, so visit stereonet.com and join up today.
Yeah, so we're here with Mark Hamilton at the Sydney Hi-Fi Show 2025, for Not an Audio File, and Mark will tell you what he does in a second, but his business is Avation, and you were saying South Africa.
Started, 15, 16 years ago in South Africa, and then in 2010 we opened a branch here.
Which is interesting. So you were still operating in Africa, South
Correct.
Africa.
Yeah.
But you had a branch on the Gold Coast.
Yes, we started in the Gold Coast, never left the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
Because why would you leave the Gold Coast?
Well, you kind of wouldn't. I mean, there's a lot that's nice about the Gold Coast.
So it's been great, and eventually sold the South African operation because this just made more sense.
Yep.
And no looking back. Yeah. Started purely doing custom, no hi-fi in the beginning.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
We started with just one custom install brand, and then built it up. Hi-fi's always been my passion, so as soon as we had the finances to bring that back into the business, we did.
And importantly, the reason why we're speaking to you is because you've got probably the fanciest and most interesting looking loudspeaker at the show.
I certainly hope so.
The Big Vivids, and they're very vivid.
Yeah, the G1 Spirits, they are in an incredible colour too, very unique colour.
Amazing colour, and sounding pretty good up there in what is a room that's... I guess some would describe it as difficult, but it is the tradition at hi-fi shows to blame the room. But
it's quite a difficult room. It's a very odd shape.
Yeah,
and
it's
enormous.
It's a big space, slightly reflective space.
Lots of windows, two glass doors as well, double glass door on the balcony. It's a tough room.
Yeah.
But I think we've got it sounding okay.
Sounding pretty good. Yeah. I think it's very nice. You've also got a few other products on display, but how did you end up with Vivid? I mean, Vivid is now, I guess, it's quite a well-marketed brand in a way for a relatively new brand. People know about it, partly because of its, I guess, striking appearance. But and there's also the designer behind it is very highly
very regarded. Famous. Yes. Yeah, very well known. It's actually remarkable, considering how good the product is, how many people don't know about it still.
I guess if you keep seeing the posts and the articles, you assume that everyone knows.
Yeah, those in the know do, but the amount of people that come through a show and have never ever heard of
the
brand.
Is that right? Okay.
I would say 80% of the people that walk into the room have never heard of it, which
80%?
Astounds me, because they probably make the best loudspeaker in the world from a technical perspective. Maybe not, it doesn't look like everyone's cup of tea, but it's all about engineering, not aesthetics.
And so there in fact is, I mean, you could, you know, with a light touch, you go, oh yeah, that looks cool. We don't really, it's very imaginative as far as its appearance.
Certainly, yeah.
One could assume that there isn't a great depth of engineering and it was more about, you know, show rather than go. But
in fact, quite the opposite.
It's the opposite. Yeah. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, the look is a result of the engineering. So they're rolling off all the resonant frequencies of every driver. So every driver is individually rolled off inside the cabinet.
Yeah, okay.
So there's no interaction between any of the drivers in the cabinet.
Okay.
So they use the same principle that Lawrence used in the Nautilus.
Yes.
Tapered tube.
Yes.
Rolling off the frequency. Obviously on the tweeter, the mid-range, even the mid-bass, that's okay. You can have the tapered tube, but what do you do when you get to the bass drivers?
Well,
you need a rather long tube.
Yeah, you would, which clearly...
So which means you need a four-meter deep speaker to roll it off. Yeah. So hence the snail shape, the long tube. So you'll see the long tube on the top of the speaker to roll off the mid-bass, and then the large cabinet at the bottom to roll off the bass drivers as well. So they're getting length without making the speaker 2 meters deep.
Okay.
So that's the reason.
Does some of that make the crossover simpler, or is that not something that he talks about much? Or
I would imagine it does.
Yeah.
Because there's no interaction between the drivers in the cabinet.
Yeah.
And they're also isolated from the cabinet. I don't know if you've had a close look.
Oh, okay.
So there's no screws on the cabinet.
No, there is not.
Yeah.
No, that
all
I have
those
noticed.
Drivers are isolated from the cabinet. They're on a silicon O-ring and they float. So they're not coupled to the cabinet.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, okay. It's a fabulous idea.
So, I suppose you don't really know how it's held in place.
So the reason it doesn't fall out is on the back of that horn loader tube. So on the end of the tube, there's a thread in there and that's attached to the back of the cabinet.
Okay.
Again, isolated with O-rings again.
Somewhat similar to some other loudspeakers that he may or may not have worked with at some point.
Yes.
So, I mean, we don't really want to talk about politics or legalities or whatever, but I mean, did he own some of the patents that are around the Nautilus, or was they run out of copyright, so to speak? Or?
I don't know what the legalities are around it, but it, it was his genius. It was his invention.
Yeah. Clearly, it was his idea. Yeah.
And at that time, they were a private company. They were innovative. They were creative. They were doing well.
Yeah.
But then they got sold and became a big corporate like so many audio companies. Yeah. And Lawrence couldn't do what he wanted to. He wanted to create the next evolution.
Oh, so,
and they wouldn't give him any engineering money or freedom.
That's why he sort of left B&W.
Correct.
Or Bowles because and Wilkins, as we meant to call it.
If you think that Nautilus is 20 years old.
Yes.
It's over 20 years old. So he knew he had to make it better. He had the ideas to do it.
Yeah.
But he couldn't get the backing of the company.
Oh, okay.
So he said, no worries, I'll do it myself.
Yeah,
and
right,
that was the birth of Vivid Audio.
And that is the... Yeah, okay. Yeah. And that's where Vivid comes from.
And that's why the engineering is of such a high level.
Yeah, okay. Well, certainly my the time that I've spent pulling 800 series loudspeakers apart, they are really kind of engineered like nothing else. And,
yeah.
And so with a high degree of thought and originality. And
that's right.
And I guess he's done that but taken it to the next level in I don't know, does he own Vivid? Is it his brand? Or
so he does own Vivid. Vivid is owned by two guys, so Lawrence.
Yep.
And the business guy behind it is a guy called Philip Guttentag.
Okay.
So he's the brains in terms of business. Lawrence is the brains in terms of engineering.
Guttentag.
Yeah.
Good day.
So yes. So obviously a German origin, but he's a South African guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was based in Durban at the time that they founded the company.
Is that right? And is that part of the connection?
Yes, they're still made in Durban to this day.
Oh, they are.
They're still manufactured in Durban.
Of course, that's one of my questions.
Yeah.
Okay, manufactured, so not made in Europe.
No, they did try. They did open a factory in the UK and started making the S12s in the UK and everything. Yeah. But you can imagine how difficult it is to make speakers in the UK cost-wise. People-wise. So it ended up being better to keep the factory in South Africa.
Okay.
But yeah, so the and it's interesting because Philip, the other founder, is also, he used to be the Bowers & Wilkins distributor in South Africa.
Right?
So there's a lot of that political history there.
Wow, okay.
So, and he's done an incredible job with the company. It's not easy to make a loudspeaker company international and such a high-end brand too. It's not cheap.
It's not cheap, and also he's not really been at it that long. I'm going to say it's not 10 years, is it?
Or it's over 10 years.
Oh, it
now.
Is over?
Yeah, it's
okay,
over
so
10 years.
So maybe a slow start, but...
Yeah.
So
slow start, but they're doing well. They're very much international. They're doing well in the US.
Yep.
Very well in Japan. China is now booming for them.
Is that right?
Well, the Moya has set the world alight. Mm-hmm. So their new speaker that they've made...
oh yes, the big
yeah,
one.
Yeah, the big, real, the crazy, really big one. Yeah. Really
oh, so
big
that's
speaker.
Actually selling really well.
I shouldn't
sound surprised, but it is a big hunk of loudspeaker.
I'm surprised because it's quite expensive. You need a very large room.
Yeah.
So I thought the market would be quite limited. But actually, I don't think they can make them fast enough at the
is
moment.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's okay. Their biggest problem.
Well,
so they've done incredibly well with it. China's part of the reason.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a really good market growing there.
Yeah, okay.
And the type of people that buy speakers in China, they are very wealthy. You know,
because that loudspeaker is 300,000 to 400,000 euro.
That's $500,000 US. It's $750,000 in Australia.
Yeah. Okay. So you're selling only about a pair a week.
Yeah, one to two pairs a week only, unfortunately.
have you landed a pair in this country?
We have not. We did press go and then we chickened out.
I can understand why.
Yeah.
I mean, that is...
Well, I think they spoke some sense into me and said, get a customer first, you know, because it's a big investment.
It is a big investment.
Not an easy sell.
I mean, that is a big investment.
Our market is limited.
You can have a lot of other stock.
You can, And also, even if you have the right customer, they have to have a big enough room.
Yes.
Those speakers are 1,200 mils deep. They're really big.
Yeah, I have seen them in the flesh once and walked around them, and they were, in fact, they were in a silly small room at Munich. They were in a cabin on the main show floor, which probably didn't allow them to sound quite right or breathe, you know. But they appeared huge in that space.
Yeah.
But they were attracting a lot of attention.
I'm sure. They're very unique design.
Yeah, well, yeah, they, and I guess, so what, I mean, I was going to say, it's sort of like a bulgy sort of thing, which I guess stiffens the panels, but What are they actually made out of? Well, I mean, is it something exotic or something incredibly normal? Like,
I don't know,
fiberglass.
So they use composite. So they use fiberglass. They use Kevlar, carbon fiber, where they need to.
Yep.
So depending on which model it is, it determines which product they're using or combination of.
Yeah, right, yeah.
On the very entry level, like the S12, which is our entry level bookshelf, that is not. That's a injection molded.
It is, yeah. Okay.
But only that product.
Yeah.
And then the rest, like on the Moyas, I don't know if you noticed when you looked at them, but it's actually four separate cabinets.
I did wonder about that.
Yeah,
And so for shipping purposes,
engineering and shipping purposes.
Well, no, I would imagine originally it was an engineering thing to sort of isolate it and allow control resonances more easily. But
in reality, it had to be that way because a pair of Moyas all packed up. In their crates and everything it's like 1,100 kilos, over a ton.
Wow.
So it does make sense to have them in four pieces.
Wow. So the big ones you've got here, and I've forgotten the model name.
They're G1 Spirits.
G1 Spirits.
Yeah.
They are taller than your average human.
They're pretty big, yeah.
Do they weigh much?
72 kilos each. It's a pretty hefty lump, and you know, chuck them in crates, they're over 100 kilos each, so yes, they weigh a bit.
Now they're painted, I take it. It's some kind of automotive finish.
It's an automotive finish, so they use automotive paint, very high quality automotive paints, and they've become quite skilled at finishes on them.
I was going to say that when I was in the room earlier taking a few pictures, and you were just giving them a quick polish. The finish is exceptional, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
particularly on that pair as well.
Yeah. Okay.
That pair is really exceptional, but there's 15 layers of paint on that speaker.
Yeah.
To get that four different colours.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's sort of a flip sort of paint finish, but it actually flips very nicely to a similar colourway rather than jumping to some other odd orangey red colour.
That's right. Yeah.
What is the situation with colour? If someone is buying a pair of your loudspeakers, at what point does customization become part of the equation?
Okay, so depending on the range, it's a little bit different between the standard range and the gears.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the Kaya range, which is the S12s, the little bookshelves going up to the 90s. So K25s, K45s, K90s, which is their biggest floor standard in the Kaya series. And that's designed to be a more cost-effective series.
So it comes in a standard array of...
That comes in like a Lexus white, which is the white we have in the room. Piano black, which they've always had, and then a color called oyster matte, which is silver, like a matte silver. Awesome. Quite stunning, actually. Yeah, so those three colors are standard and free.
Yes.
But then you can order any custom color. As long as it's a standard automotive finish, you can order it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can say, I like this.
So even on
colour,
those? Yeah.
Even
at,
on
at
those.
At a premium.
At a price.
Yeah, yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
It's not expensive, but at a price. Yeah. Then on the gears, the standard colors are basically black and white.
Yes.
However, I don't think we've ever sold black or white.
No.
I think we've sold one white.
People take an opportunity.
It's always custom. Yeah. Because at that price point, if you're going to pay an extra $3,000 to customise the colour, it's normally going to be the colour of the guy's car.
I was going to say. So you do a few Ferrari Reds then, I take
Very it. Often.
Yes.
Especially in the mining towns like Perth, it's always after the guy's
I'll tell you the
new car.
Colour
always. Always.
That's perfect.
So,
all right.
In fact, that colour in the room that's so special, that's a McLaren colour.
Is that right?
Yeah. So that's a special McLaren finish.
Okay. So are they going to a McLaren owner at some point, or are they, or is that just what you thought you'd order?
They are actually sold.
They are sold.
Yes.
Okay.
So they were custom.
Very
they were a custom colour.
All right. So. Hey, well, you know, thank you so much for the chat.
My pleasure.
Great to get some insight into how they're made, where they're made, and I've learnt a lot. And hopefully the listener has as well. So good luck
in
the show.
Thank you.
Which, of course, when this podcast goes out 2 days after the show, will be meaningless. But but judging by the crowd that's here at the moment,
I'm very impressed with the turnout today.
It's
above expectations.
I would say well above. I'm completely stoked.
We've had over 15 people at a time in the room already.
Yeah, already.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's a big space, but you can absorb it. But it's kind of filled up. And I took a photo to prove it.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure.
We'll speak to you again sometime in the future.
Thank you.
I was just talking to Jeff at Hey Now Hi-Fi about his latest installation, another Dome and turntable, this time one with a Supertrack Blackbird arm and a Mutec Hayabusa cartridge. Motorcyclists everywhere are wondering how that could be. Blackbird arm, Hayabusa cartridge. Yeah. Anyhow, then he said he was going back to the store to listen to some records on the Helix 2 in-store unit. I thought, do you ever get sick of listening to records? But then maybe not, playing them back through the Fisher & Fisher speakers that are crafted from slate. Anyhow, enough discussion of Jeff's antics. Back to the show.
And we're back with Steve Van Sliter and Spectraflora Acoustics. Or just Spectraflora, really, isn't it?
Just Spectraflora, yeah.
Yeah, you're a loudspeaker designer / manufacturer. It's a new brand, a new product.
Yep.
You're a sponsor of the show, and thank you for that.
Oh, no worries.
The speaker is not like any other speaker on the planet.
So, yeah, brownie points for having an original idea, and I don't think there's too many loudspeaker manufacturers that actually do these days. So, good on you. But how, what the hell? How, what, tell me, how? How did you come up with this? And why? And historically, you're a woodworker? Or?
No, not at all.
Okay.
An analytical biochemist.
I couldn't have got that more wrong. An analytical biochemist.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't even know what that person does.
We analyze molecules from that's living things.
Know. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you... That sounds serious.
Yeah, I was a full-blown academic for 9 years.
Okay.
And just got sick of it during COVID.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yep.
I'd actually started my own company right before COVID.
Yeah.
Doing analytical biochemistry and just ended up staring at spreadsheets and having nothing to do with people.
Yeah, okay.
And it was terrible. And so I just sort of reevaluated and thought, I'll do something I care about.
Mm.
And also I went through a couple accelerator programs and for you know, business, testing business concepts.
Yes.
And I thought this was a pretty good one, loudspeakers.
It's tried and proven. Millions of people have done it before.
Yeah, well. Millions of people are still trying it.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. Some are successful.
That's it. Yeah. But yeah, I thought I'd approach it like an R&D project, really.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And clearly, you've got a strong interest in music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a prerequisite, I suppose. But yep. Historically, much to do with electronics or acoustical engineering, or is it more?
Well, electronics. The type of analytical chemistry I did was with really fancy instruments.
Yep.
And mathematical models.
Okay.
So the maths came
easily.
Really, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I think that's a huge barrier to a lot of people. It's funny. A friend of mine asked me recently which is more complex, biochemistry or making speakers.
And?
Biochemistry, hands down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine if speakers could evolve, but you weren't really sure they did.
Yeah.
And you weren't really sure maybe what the cone was made out of. Like, it's just a nightmare, biochemistry. Whereas with speakers, models, when you model something, it's usually pretty accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. Well, it is now. I mean, I think, computer power and the equations that are inserted in the software, et cetera, kind of work these days, don't they? You know, it's probably taken 30 or 40 years to get computer design and simulation in loudspeaker modeling to where it's at.
Yeah, I'm probably spoiled coming into it where I
have. Oh, it was a different world.
Yeah.
I mean... You know, historically, and I guess we've talked about it in other episodes, but, you know, to design a speaker in the 70s was, well, really, if you didn't have the inside knowledge, the secret knowledge, you could hardly do it properly at all. I mean, the BBC was still developing their ideas about how it probably could or should be done at that point. And there was no computer, you know, simulation or even measurement, of course. And you had a chart recorder to do a frequency response measurement, which is kind of a useless thing anyhow, because it was done in one place in space.
Yep.
And unless you're in an anechoic chamber, it was not a particularly useful piece of information.
It's still not very useful.
No.
So, there's so many things to talk about. I mean, I'll start with a horn. So yep. At some point, and it's not really even a horn, is it? It's a waveguide in one plane.
Yep.
And it's a horn in the vertical domain.
That's right.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. And so the way I approached it was like a research and development project,
yeah.
right? And with pretty much no assumptions
mm-hmm.
and questioning conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all from my science background.
Of course.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's really, I mean, I guess you, that's the fun part, isn't it?
What's that? The R&D?
It's sort of like conjuring up the idea.
Yeah.
And ending up where we don't know where you're going to end up.
Yeah. And I think at the cutting edge of science, there aren't any experts, right?
Yeah.
And peer-reviewed papers are often just bullshit, right? But they're supposed to be good because they're peer-reviewed, but most of them are just garbage because someone has used statistics to prove whatever they wanted
to prove. Whatever they set out to
prove. It's nonsense, yeah. And so even sort of fundamental ideas about loudspeakers, I thought, well, these guys could be wrong. I'm not sure, but I'm going to test it.
Well, there's so many different ways that different companies go about it.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no absolutely right way.
Yeah.
I mean, comb materials, everyone's got a different favourite comb material. Everyone's got a different preferred, you know, timber material, cabinet yep. material, yeah. what have you. Or, you know, there's people making cabinets. I interviewed some people earlier in the show making the Fisher & Fisher people making cabinets out of slate.
Right.
No one else. There's a few people doing that, but I mean, there's people using marble. There's, you know, obviously fake stone.
Concrete.
Yeah, concrete, yeah, which surely is diabolical. But anyhow, yeah, so before we talk about the horn any further, what was your goal? I mean, what did you find distracting or unpleasant about a lot of other speakers, loudspeakers? Was there something that you didn't
like? Well, the price point was the first
thing. Yeah.
Okay. The markups, when you really look at some of the big brands, are just outrageous for what they actually sell you.
Mm.
And there are Australian brands that don't do that, right?
Yes.
That sell direct to consumer. Mm. And the markups are much smaller.
Yes.
But then going to hi-fi shows and listening to speakers, nothing really stood out as being impactful emotionally.
Yeah,
like okay. Like I wanted to hear music.
Yes.
There's a certain hi-fi sound that's very refined and detailed, but a little bit bland.
Well, it's hi-fi.
Yeah.
And it probably, I mean, it's one way to do it, right? That's what some people want. So, I mean, this is the problem, is that there's almost a market for everything.
Mm.
You know, because I think that's why there's so many, if we talk loudspeakers, which clearly we are, there is umpteen different ways you can do it.
Yep.
Open back, open baffle, closed, vented, transmission line, blah, 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 big, small, horns, what have you, step yep. baffles, or flat baffles. You know, there's umpteen versions. So, yeah.
I should say that friends of mine who make music and they have nice studio monitors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really impressed with, I'm still impressed with some studio monitors out there.
Yeah, okay.
I guess the problem I have with those is that you often have to use a subwoofer with studio monitors, unless you really want to spend the big bucks and get like, $80,000. Yeah, exactly. So I thought I had a shot at breaking down the components to the simplest parts and
sure.
optimizing at each stage and yep. just testing a whole lot of different ideas. And with just as an example, the waveguide, I really like the transparency of waveguides.
Yes.
But they lacked the dynamic impact of horns,
right? The intimacy of horns.
Yeah, they're kind of the same, but they're not, because I mean, a wave guide doesn't add any gain, I guess, at higher frequencies.
It's not the gain so much. I mean, they're related.
Or is it right? The directivity, more that you're trying to narrow the directivity?
I think it's the impedance matching.
Yeah. Okay.
Where that's
as in with the air.
Yeah, so that's right. Yeah. With a horn, that's in a way its primary goal, to create that gain.
Mm.
But with a waveguide, the gain is sort of ignored, and so the coupling is sort of ignored.
Yes.
But the directivity is the primary goal, right?
Yeah.
So, really like the transparency and the constant directivity of waveguides, and I really like the dynamics of horns.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd, use a horn profile in the vertical, and then a waveguide in the horizontal. And it's funny because they're two very different schools of thought.
Absolutely.
And they don't seem to get along, right? And there's no way to really mathematically reconcile the two either. So we just physically reconciled the two by putting them in the same device, and it's worked really well.
Now the drive unit that's in are we calling it a horn or a waveguide?
We'll call it a waveguide.
Call it a waveguide.
Yeah.
Is it a compression driver?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
But with a polymer diaphragm.
Okay.
And I've actually gotten a lot of questions about that today. And I think people are glad to hear that it's not titanium.
Yeah.
That it's not, fatigue.
Because they make assumptions about that, which may or may not be correct.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you must have tried different drive units, one presumes, once you've kind of got your horn or waveguide the way you wanted it. Or does it need to be subtly different for every single driver that you might want to try it with?
Yeah, it does actually.
It does. Great.
So the exit angle of the drive unit has to match the throat angle pretty much, roughly.
Yeah.
I'd say. Well, maybe not that roughly. But yeah, we did try a whole bunch of different, a lot of different compression drivers.
Yeah.
And ended up with one we're pretty happy with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good piece. It's not cheap either, I don't think. But that's kind of, we won't talk about that necessarily.
Yeah.
Unless you particularly want to, of course.
None of it's cheap. The drivers aren't cheap.
No, well, that base mid-driver is not cheap in the slightest.
No.
But what co-material is that particular? It's a Sayaz driver, I presume.
Yeah. It is, yeah. It's graphene-coated magnesium.
Yes, graphene-coated magnesium.
Yep. I should add that all the stuff that goes in the crossovers costs more than the drivers.
Oh yeah, yeah. People underestimate the cost of
that's right. Filters. Yeah.
What crossover wise, it's the age old question, and really it's given an excessive importance in my opinion. But capacitors, inductors, resistors. Do you have preferences on what type?
Absolutely. Yep. We use all copper foil capacitors for the waveguide.
Yeah.
And they're all bypassed. So, yeah, there are 42 capacitors per cabinet, if you can believe that.
Fuck.
Yeah, I just saw your face drop.
I can edit that
it's
out
funny.
Later. Oh, we say fuck on the show all the time.
No,
actually, we don't, actually. But 42.
42.
In each box.
In each box.
Okay. All right. I don't know where they all go, but...
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem is, fitting them in there.
Yeah, I mean, that is the trap. I mean, it's why a lot of people actually use electrolytics, particularly in smaller enclosures, is that a more exotic capacitor is physically larger
than
the same value.
Yeah.
And it starts sucking up your volume.
Yeah, it does.
Mm.
And I think the crossover weighs 6 kilos per cabinet as well.
That's solid. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, it's sort of distributed around the cabinet.
So multiple circuit boards or
boards? Yeah, three circuit boards, and then a few components are so big they have to be mounted off the boards.
So circuit boards as in PCBs?
PCBs,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So I've got strong thoughts on PCBs versus hardwired or whatever we're calling the alternative
method. Yeah.
You obviously like circuit boards. Do you, that don't sound any different to a sort of point-to-point wiring type arrangement? Or
that was getting the PCBs right was one of the biggest challenges, actually. Mm-hmm. It was really frustrating.
From the point of interaction between inductors and things, or are you...
That part, well, you had an inductor and a heat sink, strangely enough.
Yeah.
That was an issue. Not a huge one, but just a fascinating one in a way.
Well, it is a bit, because, I mean, presumably the heatsink's made out of aluminium.
Yep.
Shouldn't have troubled it, but you found there was a problem.
Well, if the heatsink goes to the ground plane...
Ah, yeah.
Then that's when we had problems.
Yeah, okay.
But we had solder bridges to test that.
Yep.
And then, in the end, we just don't bridge them. And yep. So the heatsink's no longer grounded.
Yeah.
But that's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, no, nothing amazes me anymore.
Yeah, all right.
No. I've just been speaking to a loudspeaker designer interesting interviews that we're doing at this show probably don't appear in linear form, so it won't make any sense to either mention or what. But we discussed the fact that, you know, loudspeaker design really is a black art. Lots of people say it isn't. They say, well, it's not anymore because, you know, you've got the superior software, blah, blah, blah. I say BS because there is so many little... I mean, there's so much to know.
Yep.
And equating in your head as a designer what kind of box material and what it really sounds like and what it's likely to do to the sound, and then you need to know that. So if you're hearing something in your own design, you go, well, maybe I'll use a different material or I'll use a different thickness or this or that, or maybe it needs a bit of bracing or whatever. I mean, some people will say, well, you should be measuring by the vibrational nature of the box, etc., and dealing with it that way by way of measurement. But the thing is, it doesn't always measurement. Like we were, for instance, also discussing the fact that you model up a thing in the computer.
Yep.
It measures beautifully on, off axis in all domains, what have you, and you think it's the shape of the curve that you're looking for. And so you build it, and it does indeed measure as you modeled it. It sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Or maybe not horrible, but uninspiring.
Well,
and not particularly musical. So you're back to, you have to listen.
Yeah,
as
absolutely.
You go.
The perfect example is we looked at about 20 different mid-bass drivers.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow.
And
that's quite a lot to work your way through.
So, that's after modeling them to even see if they were suitable.
Yes. Right?
Like, we're not just randomly grabbing 20. But for each one, we used DSP,
mm-hmm.
so that they had our standard frequency response. That was our baseline for comparing them.
Yeah.
Right? And they didn't sound the same. That it didn't sound like it was the same frequency response.
No.
So then the next step was to EQ it with DSP.
Yeah.
So that they sounded frequency wise.
Yeah.
Like our baseline frequency mm-hmm. response. So there you go, right? Like,
yeah. Proving what I just said.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
With a microphone.
Yeah.
You could have 20 mid-bass or mid-range drivers
all
measuring exactly the same.
Yeah.
And they don't sound the same.
No.
Until you EQ them. So that they do sound the same.
But at which point they measure differently.
They measure differently, of course.
This is the conundrum. So that's where, I mean, maybe it's not a black art. That's a weird term in a way. And I'm not even sure what it implies other than I guess it's you literally muddle your way through with it. And eventually you find something you like. It's probably not so bad. I think it's that. I mean, the more you do it, the better you get at it. But when you're starting somewhere... as you've done from scratch.
Yep.
It'll take a little while.
Took 4 years,
okay. Yeah. Maybe I didn't think it was gonna take that long, but you probably didn't either when you started.
I'm not sure. Yeah, if you
didn't
ask
care.
Me. No, I definitely did
yeah.
care. 4 years does seem like an awfully long time.
It's hard to get that time back.
I wouldn't trade it for anything.
It's you thoroughly enjoyed it, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's every day full time for 4 years. That's not like, it wasn't a part-time job. That really is every day.
Well, I did, with our designs, I did do a similar thing where I, because I was sort of between jobs in the sense that I'd sold the previous business and I was starting a new one. So time seemed not to be as valuable, which, I mean, you know, because I wasn't producing an income.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did spend at one point 6 months full time working on one particular design. And yeah. I look back at that and go, what a luxury that was in a way.
Yep.
Because there's no way now that our business is very busy that I could ever spend that amount of time again, which makes it impossible to develop another model, really. Yeah. Although we've got enough data collected and enough ideas sorted that we can produce a similar model yeah. much more quickly.
Yeah.
So your sort of clean sheet of paper development. Yeah, huge amount. I mean, 4 years is...
Yeah, and I think too...
I mean, some space missions were probably developed in less time, I think.
Yeah, but it's a funny one because you think, what a weird place to start with a really high-end speaker. But the key is that as a newcomer, I don't really know where you can cut corners and get away with it, right?
That's also part of this,
yeah.
this black art, yeah.
So... in a way, it makes sense to start with a no compromises design.
Yes.
Because that's easier than creating a design with some compromises where you might hit a lower price
point. That's a very good point. And in fact, the real art maybe of loudspeaker design in the affordable commercial world is exactly that. It's
yeah,
making the
of course.
Right compromises
yeah.
that aren't immediately obvious in the,
yep.
in the final outcome.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I need to learn.
That takes time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, someone like Brad Serhan, for instance, and even myself to a much lesser degree, we both would have built our first speaker when we were children, and now we're older. He's, of course, much older than me and most people. And yeah, but how, I mean, he's really been doing it kind of full time for, oh, so long, you know. 40 years, right?
Yeah.
And a bit. So, yeah, that is a problem. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, look, the next design is not going to have 42 capacitors. I can tell you that.
I bet it is.
Yeah, so some corners are going to get cut.
Well, I think your point is very valid. So you will have learned as you've gone where you can cut some corners.
That's
And
right.
they're not really corners that are cut. They
efficiencies.
That's
where the efficiencies
it sounds,
can be
It sounds worse than it actually is. I mean, you're not really cutting corners. You're measuring where the real meat of the design is at and
yep.
keeping all of that
yeah.
And then trimming some little corners here and there that really ultimately you found out don't matter as much as you
That's
might have
right.
thought.
That's right.
The visual appeal.
Yep.
The polarizing visual appeal.
Oh.
Well, I think it is. No one's actually said that to me, though, by the way. But I must say... when I saw this great poster that you've got
yeah.
At the Melbourne show, I thought that is, I mean, it's a great line drawing.
Yeah.
It's a stunning looking machine. But then in the line drawing, you don't have the pleated.
Oh, the quilted leather.
The quilted leather.
Well, that's true. That's not for everybody, but we've got.
But you don't models. Have to have that.
We've got
obviously.
Models without it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Are
you worried you couldn't handle that?
I have a problem with that, but yeah. I don't have a problem with that.
And they come with a safe word.
Okay. What's the safe word?
Well, it's pineapple, of course.
Pineapple! Of course, as always. look. As I said right at the start, unless it was the bit that I cut out, because I couldn't work out how to pronounce your rather simple name because it's been a very long day. You've got some original ideas, and I think that's to be applauded because this industry is so stuck, with very few exceptions, in the tried and proven either visual styles or... technical ways of doing
yep.
things.
Yeah.
For instance, your bass system is kind of unusual.
Yeah, it's completely unusual.
Yeah. So you could tell us a little bit about that. So it's slot loaded, is it? Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's
and
slot
what really is a slot load versus, say, bass reflex or transmission line?
An Australian loudspeaker legend has been born with the stunning new VAF Research i93 Mark V, winner of Stereonet's Floor Standing Loudspeaker Product of the Year and Sound and Image Magazine's Floor Standing Speaker of the Year, $20,000 to $50,000. VAF's i93 has redefined what I thought was possible from a loudspeaker in a domestic setting, says StereoNet. VAF Research, building award-winning loudspeakers in Australia since 1978.
Well, I guess a slot-loaded system could be as simple as just taking a direct radiating woofer and making it play through a slot.
Yeah, like BBC designs, there was the big...
The square cutout.
It's got the square cutout in front of a 15-inch driver to narrow the dispersion.
That's right. And that's actually why I started playing around with... Well, no, it actually widens the dispersion.
Widens the dispersion. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
That's why
absolutely. Widens it so it meets better with the tweeter, obviously.
Yeah. That's why I started playing around with it.
Thank you for correcting me on that. Yeah. You could have just played along and people at home would be... would be going, mistake.
No, they'd say we're both idiots.
Neither of them know what they're doing. Yes, no, widens the dispersion.
Right, but what I found is that it was just, it's just crisper, better sounding bass.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. And it must be the way it couples with the air or something like that. I'm not really sure.
No. I mean, you don't need to be sure in a way. Nope. You just prefer it, and that's that. It's part of the design.
Yeah.
And there's two drivers in there.
There are, yeah.
Kind of isobarically coupled, or are they boxing each other? Like,
yep, they move in opposition.
Yes.
Kind of like a bellows.
Yeah.
In a push-pull design.
Yes. Yep.
So what we found was that, a single woofer playing through a slot sounded better than a direct radiating woofer.
Yes.
And then two woofers facing each other playing through a slot sounded better than that.
Yeah.
And then two woofers front to back playing through a slot sounded even better than that.
Okay.
And, we're not the first people to come up with that idea, but typically they would play through a single slot and the woofers would face sideways in the cabinet, right?
Yeah.
But I wanted to keep the cabinet design narrow.
Yes.
For reasons of diffraction and dispersion and all that good stuff.
Sure.
And also for the spouse acceptance factor. So...
What's this? What is this?
The spouse acceptance factor.
What is this thing that you speak of?
Oh.
Is this an important thing in audiophile circles?
It sure is.
Although this is not an audiophile, so I guess it is important, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean... So you've had 300 people through the room or 700 people through the room today. What are they saying? What are they telling you?
It's a little embarrassing to say.
I should say that Steve's partner, Felicity, is present and chuckling and chortling in the background.
Yeah, they're pretty glowing.
So very positive, obviously, which is to be expected.
Like over the top positive.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yep.
It's like I was saying yesterday when I had a bit of a sit down and listened to them, they've got this very natural way about them. They're not hi-fi. I mean, they're hi-fi.
Oh, but now we're talking about the speakers, not the visitors.
I'd say some of the visitors have a very unnatural way about them, but that's another thing. Only some of them. There's actually a very nice group of people here at this show.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. I'm impressed with the show. The amount of turn-up and the quality of the people that have come to have a look. It's all very civilised. Bare minimum brawls down in the foyer. So it's so they like them. How do you describe the sound? I mean, what do you... And is there a speaker that you... have always liked that you kind of modeled this on?
Yeah, the JBL 4430s.
Yeah, okay.
So I've got a pair at home.
Yep.
And I quite like that horn design.
Yes.
It's very transparent for a horn.
Yeah.
Pretty funny looking.
Yep.
I know that design is polarizing, and not just visually, but for distortion reasons too. But you have to turn it up to stupidly high levels,
yes,
to get the sort of distortion people are talking about.
Yeah.
I mean,
for domestic purposes, playing it's not really an issue.
Yeah, playing a rock concert in a theater, a large theater, sure. Actually, they won an Oscar, that design, for
their use in theater and mm-hmm. studios. So I really like those. And of course, it's got a 15-inch woofer, but and it crosses over at 1,000 hertz to a titanium compression driver, mm-hmm. which I don't find fatiguing. I actually think the compression driver on those is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
These are JBLs I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what's missing is real clarity in the sort of mid-bass. Like, it'd be better off as a three-way.
Yes, yeah. It's a bit of a stretch, I guess.
Yeah, it's a compromise.
Yeah.
There you go. Compromise. They're not cutting corners. They're compromising, right?
Subtle compromises.
Yeah, well, that,
small
they're...
Small compromises.
They're one of the best-selling studio monitors ever, those 4430s.
Yeah, yeah. I hear about them all the time. They've become very... what's the word? Fashionable? In demand?
Are they?
Oh, I think
so.
Okay. In classic hi-fi circles, aren't they?
I don't know.
Are we talking about two different models? When was this? When was the 4430 first released?
1981.
No, that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. Okay.
So that was, I quite like those, but wanted lower bass extension because they surprisingly don't go that low.
Yeah, no.
Even with a 15.
Yep. Because of the sensitivity, I guess.
And then, making it three-way.
Yep.
And then getting the performance from that. That sort of horn performance, which does have constant directivity, by the way, even though it's a horn, but because it's has a diffraction slot.
Yes. Right? Yep.
So getting that constant directivity without a diffraction slot,
mm-hmm.
and that's the waveguide / horn design.
Yeah.
That we've come up.
So with. To some degree, you've retained... Well, you've obviously got a fondness for the way they sound.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
And I told you earlier, I like studio monitors. I like the way studio monitors sound.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So, talking about the box itself for a second, because I believe you make them out of ply, but they're not birch ply?
No, they're hoop pine.
Yeah, so it's from Austral ply?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, to give them a... local manufacturer a plug.
Yep.
Very local to me. I mean, it's literally half an hour across town.
Yeah.
How do you find the hoop ply? Did you try birch ply or was there
No, I never tried birch ply.
Okay, you just wanted to give that a go and see how it went?
No, the reason is because we wanted to use Australian materials.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yep.
And And so, I mean, did you ever try MDF? Because, I mean, clearly we make plenty of MDF here.
No way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not interested.
No, not at all. Plywood is much stiffer.
I mean, it's a wonderful material.
Yeah.
Stiff, light, you know, it's a coward machine in a way compared with MDF, but it's a wonderful speaker building material.
And it looks good.
It does.
People like the plywood edge on the speakers that have a natural finish.
Yes, yeah. Particularly, I can see on your horn one there. It looks very smart.
People love it.
Do you cut that in segments and glue it together? Which I guess you do. But do you just glue a whole bunch together and turn it into a solid block and then machine it out? Or
yeah, so it starts out getting CNC'd on a three-axis CNC, mm-hmm. then glued together. And finished on a 7-axis CNC router.
Okay.
Yep.
In Melbourne.
Somewhere.
In Preston, yeah, yep. Okay. Yeah, cool. And then someone's got to sand it and paint it.
That's right, yeah.
You say that like that's fun. Because
well, I haven't sanded any of these myself in a while.
It's fine if you pay someone else to do it. It's doing it yourself.
It's fine until you get the invoice for someone else.
Yeah. I look at that horn and go, that's a laborious process making that horn.
It is, yeah.
But you wanted to make it out of ply rather than some kind of... I mean, clearly it's not potentially practical to make it... I mean, you're not going to mould it at this stage. It's not worth doing the tooling and so forth. You're not presumably making enough.
They would probably be cheaper.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So so it's an expensive process to make that solid ply.
It's wildly expensive. You should see the 7-axis CNC. It's just a huge robotic arm.
Yeah.
With a movable platform for the other
yes.
couple axes.
Yes. I mean, that's a hell of a machine. I guess that's a $2 or $3 million machine, is it, or something?
I'm not sure.
You didn't ask them?
No. Yeah,
you should ask them. It's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
That's a serious bit of equipment, and it actually requires a serious bit of programming and so forth.
That's right. Yeah, I've been really fortunate to work with a great group of people in Preston.
Yep.
They're very smart, and like you said, great at programming, and all the tool pathing and all that goes into getting a massive robot.
There's a huge skill set there. It's bad enough What do I work in? What'd you just say? Three axis. I mean, it's been a long day. I've forgotten what my router is, how many axes it's got.
Yeah.
It is three, isn't it?
Yeah, at first it's three.
Yeah, so you got three. Crix have got a five axis machine, and then a seven axis, as you say, is it's a five axis machine with a movable bed or whatever.
That's right.
Spins the thing around. Yeah.
Well, it's not like a five axis for metal CNC.
No.
It's just a giant robotic arm.
Yeah. It's got a sort of a. The head swims in two planes.
The first, before we moved to the waveguide horn design, we just tried a straight up horn.
Yeah.
For the first pair of prototypes.
Just to get something happening.
And that was cut on a three axis CNC.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of can if you're a bit creative. It'd take a while.
Yeah.
As far as the tooling. And then it would be wrong, and you'd have to do it all again.
It sounds like a silly thing, but the problem is there's no draft angle on the sides of the waveguide.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates a problem with three-axis CNCs. Because
you can't get in there.
Well, the router bit, burns.
Yes.
As it gets in and out, like you're saying.
Yep. I still can't get over how they look. They're... I mean, anyone who's listening here, just go to spectraflora.com.
Just.com.
And have a look at these things. Alrighty.
Yeah, that's about it.
Thank you so much. It's not what I expected to hear. It's all much more interesting and enlightening. And thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, pleasure.